Did you know that the 4th of July is on a Thursday this year? That's going to be a full weekend of fun out on the deck, 4 days. But if your deck isn't what it used to be and you aren't using it for great family gatherings, you need to call my friends at All Weather Decks. All Weather Decks is a 24-time winner of the Angie Super Service Award. And they probably help one of your neighbors. Click on the map link at allweatherdecks.net. Call All Weather Decks today at 913-206-1974 or go to allweatherdecks.net and mention you heard it on 810. Call now and relax.
All right, we continue right here on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Jason Anderson with you, Corey Anderson and Beards. Thank you to Adam Teicher joining us in the 11 o'clock hour, talking some Chiefs football heading into the playoffs. The 2 seed taking on the Steelers on Sunday night, a little Sunday night football. We are talking the national championship game from last night, some college football with our college football insider, Braden Gall, 440 Podcast Network, Athlon Sports, ESPN Radio, the Cover 2 podcast, Fringe Element podcast, and joining us here in the zone. Braden, how are you, sir?
Doing well. I sort of feel a little bit like Stetson Bennett looked on Good Morning America today. I'm leaning a little bit. I've got about 4 hours of sleep under my belt, but excited about what took place in the game and all that good stuff. So no complaints.
Was Stetson Bennett looking like that more because of lack of sleep or because of the liquid consumption?
Yeah, I placed the over-under on 1.5. It is up to you to decide what that 1.5 is. Is it 1.5 bottles of whiskey? Is it 1.5 hours of sleep?
Under.
Is it 1.5 really close friends last night? Like, who knows? 1.5 is the over-under on all of the things in Stetson Bennett's life last night. And I will say this about it. Like, if I'm him, I would just buy a condo, a townhouse, downtown, like on the square in Athens, Georgia, and just be Stetson Bennett the rest of my life. Like, you don't have to do anything. You probably could just walk out of your house every morning, walk around Athens, have all of your meals paid for, probably have people take care of your utilities and your mortgage. You'd be a pitch man for a car dealership. Like, you literally are just... Stetson Bennett literally does not have to do anything but just be Stetson Bennett the rest of his life, and he will have a wonderful career and make just enough. He'll make plenty of money.
Office Space. What do you want to do, Stetson? Nothing. I want to do absolutely nothing. And he could actually be a millionaire doing it, you know? Just wants to be a millionaire and not do anything.
I know that we get into, like, really heavy debates about athlete compensation and... And I've talked to a lot of former athletes about this, but, like, there's no question that even though it's not part of the equation, like, it doesn't count as compensation, but being a quarterback that wins a national title or a basketball player at Kentucky or who even just gets to a Sweet 16 or something, like, you create inherent value for yourself by being in one of these programs, that especially these big programs, football and basketball. Like, you don't have to be, like, an NBA player or an NFL player to build a brand for yourself that's so solid and so respected and so important in a specific community that you can just, like, being the starting quarterback at Alabama, you don't have to win a national title. You can probably go on to a media career. You can go on to be a pitchman. Like, you can do whatever you want. But if you happen to be the guy at Georgia who also breaks the 40-year drought, like, all bets are off at that point.
And especially when people love the story of preferred walk-on to JC, to getting a scholarship, to being buried on the depth chart, to being undervalued, to being the reason why they're going to lose, to being the weak link as to why Georgia can't beat Alabama, to then being a guy who makes plays there at the end and throws the 40-yard touchdown pass and they win the game. That story is pretty incredible at college football.
Yeah, and a couple of things, right? Like, number one, that's the kind of story that only happens in college sports. That isn't a story that is possible in professional sports. It's part of why we love the college game. I know it's part of why I love the college game is the guy who looks like he's just a rec league player, you know, is the guy that's out there that can win championships. And I think it's why we have the connection we do with college athletics. I don't think, like, there's anything bigger picture to read into Stetson Bennett being successful. Like, oh, our team's going to start recruiting differently at the quarterback position. Undersized is fine if you can run a little bit. And like, I don't think there's any greater meaning to be taken away if he was just on the right team at the right time and right coach and, you know, best defense in 40 years. And it worked. I will say though that he did. And what's interesting is that they still did it their way. Like, they didn't really truly evolve ever into some modernized offense. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, it was super ironic that I was screaming into the Twitter sphere and at my television to run the damn ball the entire time because it was working and they weren't doing it. And Todd Monken was upsetting me, the offensive coordinator for Georgia. And that's ironic because all season we've asked, can Georgia win the big game, beat Alabama in a national championship setting without evolving their offense and going to JT Daniels, who creates a more dynamic, you know, passing attack. And of course, the way they had to beat Alabama was to go the other direction and run the football and play between the tackles and be physical and win at the point of attack, one-on-one battles. And I think it's fun for the sport that we had that style of championship team. I think it's good for the sport that someone other than Alabama has won. I know there is SEC fatigue out there, and that's a real thing that obviously these conference commissioners are trying to address, not particularly efficiently, but they're trying. You know, it was a great game. The tension was spectacular from the beginning. That's sort of how I evaluate a game, is like on every play, how tense is my body? Like, how anxiety riddled do I feel? And like it was from the first snap, I felt like unbelievable level of tension. And again, there's also hope that someone other than, you know, Nick Saban can be beat. He is the greatest coach of all time. He's got 7 rings at 2 schools. But you could also point out 5 or 6 other times, which is also a testament to why he's great, where he lost in championship, quote-unquote championship settings. And in 08, he was undefeated in the SEC championship game. They lost to Tebow. I bet you they go on to beat Oklahoma if they beat Tebow, you know, undefeated Alabama, because they went on to win the national title the next year. 2014 Ohio State upsets them in the national semifinal. I'm willing to bet you they would have been a heavy favorite over Oregon. Same thing, they lose to Deshaun Watson on a final play of a game in 16. They get smoked by Trevor Lawrence in 18. I guess technically they were undefeated when they lost to LSU and Joe Burrow. So in theory, if they won that game, they would have been probably geared toward an SEC championship and a playoff berth. And then, of course, last night with Kirby. So, you've got 4 different programs, 3 different coaches that have beaten – 4 different coaches that have beaten Nick Saban in championship settings. And while that, you know, sort of cements Nick Saban's greatness, because, yes, he's got 7 rings, but he also could have had, like, 11, which is terrifying because, again, they're without their 2 best receivers last night, and they still almost win a national championship with a team that's probably not even, like, one of Nick Saban's top 8 or 9 teams ever at Alabama. That's the scariest part of watching that game last night. But it also means it can be done. You can beat him. If you have the right pieces and the right players and you recruit at a high enough level, you can beat Alabama and Nick Saban. It can be done. And we've now seen it from Ohio State. We've seen it from Florida. We've seen it from Clemson. We've seen it from LSU. And we've seen it from Georgia. The one common theme between all of those is elite-level athletes. You got to have elite-level athletes. But if you can do that, you can beat Alabama. You can do it. It can be done. It's hard. It's rare, but it can be done.
See, we're visiting with Braden Gall. One of my main takeaways, too, is, you know, going into the game, there was a lot of talk about Stetson Bennett. Like you said, go to Daniels, do something, run the football. If they don't win that game, do they have to then revamp their offense and become more modern to go along with the times? I mean, Nick Saban has done that over the times and has become more modern, has wide receivers all over the place, has quarterbacks that are winning, you know, the Heisman and being first-round draft picks. It's the first time, really, that you could say that, you know, in the playoff era, that Nick Saban has not won a national championship and was because a team beat him that didn't have a transcendent or stud quarterback. Like Cardale Jones is maybe the only one, but even Cardale Jones was awesome in the Big Ten championship game and the semifinal and the national championship game. But Deshaun Watson, Trevor Lawrence, Joe Burrow, and now Stetson Bennett are the ones. Like, to me, that was, if they lost last night, I would have looked at it and said, you need the players that Alabama has But you cannot beat Nick Saban unless you have a difference-making quarterback as well. And what Kirby Smart in Georgia showed is that, yeah, Alabama can be had without a Deshaun Watson, a Trevor Lawrence, a Joe Burrow, or even a Cardale Jones, who was a fourth-round draft pick in the NFL. You know, not like, you know, Stetson Bennett, who will really popular around Athens.
No, I think Cardale is probably the closest one of all the teams we just talked about. I don't think it's even close. It's sort of Stetson Bennett and Cardale Jones on one tier, and then like Tebow, and Trevor Lawrence. Now, I will say what's interesting about the Trevor Lawrence team, because they sort of had the same defensive line as Georgia. When you looked at that Clemson D-line in 2018, where you had, like, I think it was three first-round picks and four guys that are playing in the league, that, you know, Isaiah Simmons, I think, was on that team as well, if I'm not mistaken. So you had a defense that maybe not as dominant as Georgia, but pretty darn close, but also the transcendent quarterback and all the skill weapons, and that is why it was a blowout, frankly. Like that,
even as
a freshman quarterback, that's why it was a blowout. What made last night so fun is, and again, I know the score ended up being two scores in double digits, and it obviously was a little much, much closer game than that. But I think the defense is what made is what I mean. This is master of the obvious stuff here, but the defense was the thing that was rare, right, in college football. That was the rare thing. It wasn't Trevor Lawrence. It wasn't Joe Burrow, which was. You know, you look at LSU's roster around Joe Burrow, especially on offense, that's rare. Like, to see, like, four NFL receivers and running backs around a first-round pick who's going to lead the Bengals back to the playoffs, like, that's rare stuff. And what's rare about Georgia is the defensive front. Like, not even the secondary. I will say that I think vastly underrated through the entire season, preseason, and it's the reason I had money on Georgia in February, and it's the reason I had money on Georgia last night, and the reason I picked Georgia to win the Sunday after they lost to Alabama, is that all of the weapons around Stetson Bennett are vastly underrated. They're completely undervalued. Zamir White, James Cook, Brock Bowers, George Pickens, Burton, Washington, the offensive line. Like, that's no different than your normal Alabama juggernaut offense. The only difference, of course, is you had Jake Coker instead of, you know, Mac Jones or Tua. And so I do think that you look at, like, Georgia was the better team. They were the better team going into the game. They were the better team all season. They were the better team for 12 games other than the SEC title game. I thought they were the better team last night. The only thing that kept them from being even more dominant, I think, was the way that they called that game. I thought Todd Monken was, like, at one point, I think they had 13, like, White and Cook had 13 carries for, like, 130 yards rushing, like, early in the third quarter. And I'm looking around going, like, why is no one screaming to run the football? And they did, and it's how they got the lead. And so, and then they, of course, they went away from it, and that caused some problems, but then the defense saved the day. So, again, I think there was some, the roster Kirby Smart has put together is the rare thing. And again, that's the thread. 2014 Ohio State, 2019 LSU, you know, some of those Clemson teams, like like even that 08 Florida team that beat him and knocked him out of the championship game with Tebow, both teams were undefeated in Atlanta. The thing that ties them all together isn't just necessarily the super quarterback, although there's plenty of them. It is the roster full of 37 NFL players. That's the thing that ties them all together, because that's what Alabama has. And you have to have that to even sort of start the conversation to compete with them.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't want to be to where, you know, it's a prisoner of the moment or recency bias. It happens a lot, and I certainly think in sports radio and in just sports media and conversations, even just at the local watering hole, the things that happens as well. But, you know, we've talked about Clemson when they won a national title with Deshaun Watson and then Trevor Lawrence. And I know they had a down year by their standards this year, and they've lost some coordinators, and we'll see what Dabo does moving forward. But there was a feeling of, okay, has Dabo built another Alabama there at Clemson, that he's getting some stud players, that defensive line, which is a difference maker, and the transcendent quarterback that he can go and win a couple of national championships against Nick Saban. And, you know, now I wonder, and again, trying not to be prisoner of the moment, now I wonder, you know, because of what Kirby Smart is doing in stacking recruit top five, top two, number one recruiting class on recruiting class on recruiting class the last 5 years, and if they have, what's his name, Brock Vandergriff, if he turns out to be as advertised, Kirby Smart could be putting the level of player on the field as Alabama, but then throwing in a difference-making quarterback. And that's where Alabama got so dominant, because it went from Coker to then Hurts and Tua and Mac Jones and Bryce Young, and it wasn't just the figure out somebody to hand the ball off, A.J. McCarron and, you know, guys like that. So I wonder if the next level for Kirby Smart is if this Brock kid turns out to be as good as advertised. Like, are we going to watch Georgia beat Alabama for the next 4 years or so?
And what's you know, being the prisoner of the moment is saying they don't necessarily need it to if he keeps recruiting like space aliens on defense. But here's the thing about Nick Saban in Alabama, and again, you can tie this to Urban Meyer in Ohio State, Urban Meyer at Florida, Dabo at Clemson. You could tie it to Coach O at LSU. The teams that have broken through and won during the Saban's, you know, era, it is all of these guys have dealt with the same couple of issues, which is mass player turnover, the quarterback thing you're talking about, but also coaching staff stuff. And the guy who has done all of that better than any of them, the guy who has removed all of the human element from the game, is Nick Saban. He's the guy who can replace all of those people and keep the program moving. You know, we're going to find out about Dabo if he can do that. Urban Meyer can't get out of his own way. He was the problem, even though he was the reason they were great. Urban's always been the problem. I don't really know how to describe it other than he's just kind of like a giant tool. I don't know how to describe like the dysfunction he creates around himself. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of that's the opposite of the Nick Saban effect, where he brings in dysfunctional coaches and makes them whole again. And you know, Coach O, sure, you can hit on the transfer quarterback, you can recruit five-star athletes, and you can hit on the genre-defining coordinator that you snagged from the New Orleans Saints and Joe Brady. Like, you can hit on all that stuff once, but you can't sustain it year over year over year over year. And I think Kirby has a far more sustainable model. Like, his defense, as long as he keeps recruiting at that level, at that side of the ball, they're always going to be the team to beat in the East, or one of the top two in the SEC, or a playoff contender, you know, whatever phrase you want to use. But they're also going to show us they're about to lose their defensive coordinator. So, and he's changed coordinators some. So I think Kirby's model is sustainable. We're going to learn a lot about Dabo Swinney, because he's losing all of his guys. Like, he lost the program defining quarterback. He lost the defensive line. He's lost both coordinators. Let's find out just how stable your program is, because it was pretty stable for a long time through all of that winning. And in the meantime, Nick Saban was losing guys every, you know, he's got head coach at Ole Miss, a head coach at Michigan State, a head coach at Texas, you know, like head coach at Miami, like all the dudes off that 15 staff, they're all coaching everywhere at like major programs. So we got to find out if Dabo can do that. Kirby's going to have to deal with that some too. I just think Kirby recruits at it. Even against Clemson, Kirby recruits at a different level than Clemson. They're close, but Kirby's guys are, his recruiting is absurd. Him and Jimbo Fisher are the only two guys that have sort of quote unquote out recruited Nick Saban at any point during the last 10 years. So that they're at a different level, and it's why they won that game. Because how many teams can allow Alabama with Bryce Young to drive into their 30, inside their 30-yard line, and get stopped five times? How many defenses have that ability to bow up and stop the Heisman Trophy quarterback from scoring five separate times? That, there's just nobody else in college football that can do that right now.
Well, that was the concern from other teams around the South, and really in college football, and probably the frustration that was there with Georgia fans, is that, you know, can you get somebody in there who, one, is a good enough coach, but also is just a dynamic recruiter, because the players are there and they were going elsewhere. I mean, you know, Deshaun Watson and Trevor Lawrence go to Clemson. I mean, that helps out Dabo Swinney, right? I mean, you know, you get guys like that. And there are so many players in the state that, you know, now Georgia wins a national championship. Kirby Smart is recruiting at a, you know, an extremely high level. So they've got everything in place and an incredibly fertile recruiting ground of guys that probably look at it and go, my dream is to go to Georgia, while Alabama's looking at it and going, well, son of a gun, because now we've got real threat right there that won a national title, that's in Georgia, where we can go and get a lot of players, where there are a lot of players to be had that are difference makers on teams. Yet now, like it always used to be in Texas, was UT number one, and then almost every other school in the nation, if they offer, that's fine, but I want to go to Texas. I mean, that may be the case in Georgia the next couple of 3 years, where Kirby Smart can just simply you know, go and pick out who he wants out of the state.
I don't think it's as it's a great discussion. I don't think it's as loyal as Texas can be. Mm-hmm. Like I think Texas, and also to be honest with you, Jimbo Fisher is a part of this conversation because he's the only other guy really in America recruiting at the same level as Georgia and Alabama.
True.
He just needs to break through. I think in, you know, sort of the punchline of Jimbo, oh, look how good they are, they only won 8 games. I think that's a little short-sighted. I mean, they were 5th in the nation last year, one spot out of the playoff. I would argue they were definitely better than Texas A&M and Notre Dame and belonged in the playoff as a one-loss team. So it's not like they haven't been very, very, very close. They beat Alabama this year with a backup quarterback. So I think A&M's still a team to keep an eye on. Very similar to Georgia, very fertile recruiting state. All the stuff you just said about Georgia, you could say kind of about Texas A&M. Mm-hmm. Jimbo's even got a national title ring. He just doesn't have it at A&M. So very, very similar situation. So the waters are getting a little deeper around Nick Saban. The question I have about, and Georgia's fascinating as a state because I think it's past California in terms of talent production. I think Florida and Texas are clearly 1 and 2. But I don't think players grow up in Georgia as loyal to Georgia as people in Texas grow up as loyal to Texas, if that makes sense. I think Texas has a stronger, you know, hold on the hearts and minds of young kids in the state of Texas, whereas you grow up, depending on what place in Georgia you grow up, you might actually be closer to Gainesville, closer to, you know, Columbia, South Carolina, or Clemson, South Carolina. You might be closer. Like, if you grow up in Macon or, you know, any part of southwest state of Georgia, you're much closer to Auburn and Alabama than you are even to if you grow up near Chattanooga, you're close to Knoxville. So I just think it's such a I think the state itself is such a battleground. But overall, it has increased in production value in terms of talent by a large margin. It used to be behind Pennsylvania, behind Ohio, behind some of these states, and now it's ahead of California. So, and this is the problem with college football, frankly. Tennessee is producing 40 Power 5 kids. When I went to high school here in Nashville in 1999 and graduated 2000, and I had scholarship offers to play at, you know, Washington University, and I'm not talking about the real Washington University, right? Like, I'm talking about the one by you guys. Like, tiny, tiny, tiny offers. Like, there were maybe 5 or 6 kids in the state of Tennessee that were going to Power 5 school. Now there's 45 of them. And that's the same in Mississippi. That's the same in Louisiana, like Louisiana, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Kentucky. Like, all these states in the South are producing even more players. And I don't know how that works and helps college football's sort of regionality problem right now, because what you need is a really healthy Pac-12, and you need good Michigans and good Notre Dames and good Ohio States and good Oklahoma. You need all these other teams to be good. You know, we just saw Michigan at its best in 20 years, and it wasn't even close to being good enough. We've seen Notre Dame have the best 10-year stretch of Notre Dame modern and Notre Dame football in 30 years, and it wasn't even close to good enough. So I don't know what we do to solve that problem. I think, you know, Lincoln Riley making USC good would be a good first step, but I don't know what else we do to sort of stop the regionality and the domination of the Southeast right now.
Yeah, the loyalty is an interesting point where I'm with you that Texas is pretty loyal. As opposed to Georgia, and as you said, a number of schools that you might be closer to than actually, you know, Georgia. One thing I would wonder is, you know, for so long Georgia was good, and they were talked about, could this team win a national title? Are they good enough this year, especially under Mark Richt for so many years? But then they seem to be underwhelming overall, or just not good enough to a level. Since Georgia played in the national title when they lost to Hurts and then Tua, you're talking about kids that were 14 if you're a senior this year, right? So you were 13, 14 years old in the state. I wonder in 2 or 3 or 4 years you could have 9 and 10-year-olds that when they first started watching college football was when Georgia was already playing for a national title and then won a national title. And if they win another one, like, that starts that loyalty in the state to where they go, I'm in Georgia. I want to play for Georgia because, you know, they're one of the best teams and they're winning national titles. And that's all I've known since I've, you know, been watching college football.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I'm sort of going to talk in circles here because Georgia, nobody's as loyal as the state of Texas is to Texas, right? Maybe Ohio with Ohio State, maybe. But, like, there's not many you know, states that have sort of the passion of, like, we tie our high school existence to the college in the state. But talking in circles here, to me, I still think that, and while you're right, how many other programs in America have played in two national title games in the last 10 years? How many have? There's not many. Georgia's one of the few. It's basically like Bama, Clemson, and Georgia.
Yeah.
That's basically it. I do think that literal mileage makes a huge difference here. And that's what I was getting at with Georgia.
Yeah.
It's like in Texas, you are so spaced out from meaningful programs, like physically spaced out. Like where how far can you go from Austin in every direction before you hit a meaningful program? And if we want to talk about Baylor and Texas Tech and TCU and SMU and call them meaningful, that's fine. How many, Baylor used to be one of the worst Power Five programs in the history of the world. So like let's be honest about the job, Art Briles and Dave Aranda did is nothing short of a miracle, and obviously Art Briles for very terrible reasons. But A&M and Oklahoma would be the only two like meaningful programs I would point to that's within how many hundreds of miles of Austin. If you look at Athens and you draw a six-hour radius around Athens, you're talking about four, five, six, seven programs that want to compete for national championships.
Yeah.
And that's the difference, I think, with like physical proximity in the state of Georgia is sort of a problem. But again, also people grow up in Georgia loving Georgia too. It's we're splitting hairs here to some degree.
For sure.
But the point is, can Kirby sustain this? And I think the answer is 100% yes. And a lot of it will be built on in-state talent mixing in the Brock Bowers of the world, where you go get a guy.
Yeah.
And that's where we get back to the Pac-12 has to keep those types of players home. Like the only way college football can get back to sort of like true national relevance is if the West Coast can keep Bryce Young and Matt Corral and Brock Bowers. And, Kayvon Thibodeau staying on the West Coast was a big deal for the Pac-12.
Yeah. And U.S. Army All-American got a couple of guys in that made their announcement that stayed on the West Coast, one at USC as well. I thought it was, visiting with Braden Gall, College Football Insider, Saban looked genuinely happy for Kirby Smart. Obviously, he clearly respects Kirby as one of his former assistants, because I don't think he would have the same reaction if, say, that was Ole Miss that they were playing and they won. But he goes out there losing a national championship game and is smiling and going, "You kicked our ass in the fourth quarter." That showed me a lot as to the respect that Nick Saban has towards Kirby Smart.
I agree with that. And I do think that there's a weird thing there with Lane Kiffin that just Lane Kiffin does to people. There's
True.
No question about that. But he's also been, I think, Brian Kelly is like an old angry curmudgeon. While Nick Saban can come across that way, especially towards the media, I don't think that's who he is, especially since when the tornadoes hit and he became a grandfather and like all that stuff kind of happened. And, I think it was like, I don't know when it was, 2011, 2012, 2013, somewhere in there, he already had like four national titles. And I think there was a softening of Nick Saban from a human side of things, that it doesn't change how he works every day. It doesn't change the process. It doesn't change how, the recruiting and the tactics and, how he speaks to the media to motivate his players. Like, it doesn't change any of that. But I do think the human changed at some point. And I think, I think if Steve Sarkisian beat him a national title game, I think he would say the same thing. I think if, Bill O'Brien, which will never happen, but if Bill O'Brien ever like beat him in a serious moment, I think that would, he would feel the same way. Kirby's a little different because of how much time he spent there.
Yeah.
That he spent so much time and won so much and helped Nick Saban do so much. Now, they did have their little tiff when they left, and there's some really funny rumors about Kirby Smart, taking photos of recruiting boards on the way out and showing recruits and stuff, like some stuff you probably wouldn't respect if you were Nick Saban. But it's come around, and he's a worthy adversary. They obviously have a long relationship. And to do it at his alma mater, with a walk-on. Like, I think Saban understands sort of the big picture view of where he's at and where Kirby's at and where the sport's at, and I think he has a greater appreciation of all those things since sort of softening a few years ago. But again, it doesn't change the fact that his team's the best team normally. And they'll be number one next year with, a terrifying thought is Bryce Young and Will Anderson both coming back, of course. So,
Yeah, that is terrifying. Braden Gall is our guest, and you talk about the SEC fatigue. I put out the stat last night. I mean, four of the last six national championship games, an SEC team has lost. I mean, it's just ridiculous. They get there, and they seem to lose those games a lot. Braden Gall, I mean, yeah, they might have lost to SEC teams, but that's not the point. They are losing these national championship games, too.
Well, go even further, and I'll just real quickly, go even further. BCS era, 98, which is right around the time the internet and recruiting took a big step forward. We started caring about how we acquired talent a lot more. The budgets changed in athletic departments. The TV contracts went through the roof. Coaching contracts went all through the roof. It all ties in with how we determine a champion in 98. And I could argue 21 of the 24 national champions have come from the Southeastern footprint, if I include Oklahoma. If I don't include Oklahoma in 2000, which was like a millennial, almost literally a millennial ago, I would 20 out of 24 national championships have come from states that are quote-unquote SEC states, because Texas is in an SEC footprint. Miami and Florida State and Clemson are all in SEC footprints. Ohio State won in 02 and 14, and USC won in 04. That's it. That's it. In 25 years, the South as a region, not just the SEC, has dominated the sport, and that is the problem we are trying to solve.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the solutions are. I think there's a lot of things that people think are going to work, but I don't. You can't move families from you can't move all these defensive linemen from Georgia and put them in Iowa. That's not going to happen. So I don't know how we figure out a way to manage talent acquisition without hurting the athlete, and that's the only way you can really disperse the talent. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, Again, I don't know how you do that without actually hurting the labor force first.
Yeah. Petey Bell and Blue Chips moved Butch McRae's mom, so that worked out for them. And
there you go.
She kept her house. All right, last one real quick. Who wins the national championship next year?
Oh, man, I haven't even had time to dive into that. But, Bama's going to be so good, and it's just such a boring answer. I do think that
– can't go wrong guessing Bama.
Right. I'll leave you with, what I do think philosophically about looking at all these rankings, and we're going to do it too on our shows. We're going to look at teams that we think are going to be great next year. I think there's a lot more volatility in college football after the top four or five teams. So you're going to see a lot of teams ranked really highly, whether it's Michigan State or Wake Forest or Pittsburgh or, teams that sort of jumped into the fray this year. I just think we get so caught up in what we just saw is going to be what's going to be, and that's not how college football works. It's that way at the top.
Mm-hmm.
It's the teams that recruit the best. It's going to be those top 3 to 6 to 7 teams. But everywhere else, what we need to start doing to appreciate the game more is understand that Michigan is going to come from 36 in the preseason to make the playoffs sometimes. We're going to get a Wake Forest and a Pittsburgh team that were unranked in the preseason that are going to win 10 games. That's the stuff we need to appreciate more. So when you look at preseason rankings and your team's not ranked there, who cares? Just know that your team's got a really good chance to do something special next year, because nobody's going to anticipate it, and that happens in every preseason top 25, especially in January.
Braden Gall, 440 Podcast Network, Athlon Sports, ESPN Radio, Cover 2 Podcast, Friend Element Podcast. Braden, you're the man as always. I appreciate it, sir. Had a blast during the college football season. We will talk soon, probably some NFL football, as you're there in Nashville, the Titans with the number one seed, Chiefs with the 2 seed. Appreciate it, man, as always, and we'll talk soon.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure.
All right, there's Braden Gall. Again, college football insider. Great stuff from him joining us as we wrap up the college football season. Probably wasn't a good one, but I don't think he got the joke that I was given about the SEC fatigue. The SEC's lost four of the last six national championship games. I mean, just tired of them going there and underachieving.
Put some respect on them.
That's right. They keep losing national championship games. It's ridiculous. That's what the fatigue is. Underachievers.
Is the SEC the Buffalo Bills of college football?
They are, while also being the Tom Brady of college. Can Tom Brady play himself? It's like Tom Brady keeps losing these Super Bowls. Well, yeah, but he's also winning as well. All right, we take a timeout. We come back. Let's talk some Chiefs football. I asked Adam Teicher in the 11 o'clock hour if there's a player or if there are players that he looks at on the Chiefs team that could step up and have big stretches of football in the postseason like we saw in 2019 We'll go through some of those players we may have in mind, the three of us. We'll do that on the other side of the break. More Zone rolling along. We've got Todd Lebo at 1 o'clock, Factor Fiction. Still more Zone on a Tuesday on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
The Zone with Jason Anderson.
Because now you can't even get a good Kai something latte tea
chai
at Starbucks.
Tea. That's a chai tea, yeah, Jason. Chai, yeah.
Sorry, whatever. Chai tea. Kai, chai, kai, zai, zai, kai, zai, zai, kai, zai,
kai, 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 tea. Omega.
Weekdays from 10 to 2 on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
Total Bowl coming up at 1 o'clock as we'll hang out with him. Do some fact or fiction. Roy Williams returning to Allen Fieldhouse tonight. We'll hear from Bill Self in the 1 o'clock hour as well. Also Tristan Inaruna at Iowa State. Bigger deal, Roy Williams or Tristan Inaruna returning to Allen Fieldhouse?
Probably Roy.
Tristan?
Probably Roy.
Okay.
Did you see the great news for Sporting KC?
Yeah, I don't think it's great.
It's not.
It is news. It's huge news. It's just not great.
Alon Polito is going to have knee surgery on the 17th, and he is done for the year.
Ouch.
So that's been
Ouch.
A disaster.
Yeah.
People want to rag on the Frank Clark deal.
Whew.
At least they won some playoff games in a Super Bowl with Frank Clark. Alon Polito, he's been good when he's played.
When he's played.
But that's been a disaster. I mean, that's Adalberto Mondesi on the pitch.
Without all the money.
Yeah.
Without having to pay all the money. To be able to purchase that contract. So, yeah, that is unfortunate. Rough news for Sporting. We talked with Adam Teicher in the 11 o'clock hour, and one of the last things we talked about was looking at the 2019 season and some of the players that stepped up and had big stretches, had big games, and if there are players on this Chiefs team that you would look at and say, okay, I think this person's a candidate, that person's a candidate to be able to do that. In 2019, the names that that I remember as having big stretches that maybe was not what they were doing on a consistent basis in the regular season. Sammy Watkins certainly had a phenomenal postseason run, 14 receptions, 288 yards, and a touchdown in three games. Kendall Fuller played well most of the season, but then he also had to switch positions and play the deep safety spot when Thornhill went out. And so he stepped up and had some big plays and an interception. Damian Williams was really good late in the season, fresh legs because he was injured, and you know had the touchdown to get things started against the Houston Texans, and then was awesome in the Super Bowl. Dan Sorensen had big plays in 2019, a number of them, and then Frank Clark became Clark the Shark in the playoffs. He was good down the stretch, and then he was really good in the postseason. And so, you know, we always compare things to 2019 and this year and things like that. Who are the candidates for you that come to mind if I say, you know, this person, not a star, it can't be Kelce or Hill, but if they win the Super Bowl and you look back and go, yeah, this person had a really good stretch and is going to be viewed as such for a long time.
So one of the and we're just talking candidates because it's really impossible to predict because all we know is what we see of these guys week in and week out. To me, one of the candidates, because of the way he's become viewed in this city, is Clyde Edwards-Helaire. Damian Williams was one of those guys, you know, that went on that run in the postseason and was huge in the Super Bowl. Clyde has been kind of a disappointment. He's been hurt. I do think he's still the best back on this team. And I think that, assuming he's healthy, they keep talking about him getting closer. I don't think they'd be talking about that because they've got these other guys in the running back room where they don't feel like they have to have Clyde. I think that he's got a shot, if he can play, to be that guy that kind of bursts onto the scene. On the other side of the ball, we already know what he can do, but I think L'Jarius Sneed is the guy that I put at the top of the list of becoming a household kind of name that makes the kind of plays in the postseason that people will remember forever. So those are the two guys I'm looking at as the kind of guys to put like breakout playoff performances on the board.
The Clyde Edwards-Helaire is an interesting one because I looked at the running back position for the Chiefs and I just skimmed right past Edwards-Helaire because
I know one of yours is going to be probably Jerick McKinnon.
It is.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just because we just saw what he can do or what he did in that game against the Broncos.
And right now, people probably think more highly of Jerick McKinnon than they do Clyde Edwards-Helaire.
I mean,
he's gotten, because he got drafted in the first round by no fault of his own, Chiefs fans hold that over his head. And I still think he's the best back on this team. Mm-hmm. He's just got to get on the field.
It might also be, you know, a little bit of rooting for your prediction. I thought McKinnon was one of the more underrated signings of the offseason. I thought he would be used more. if he could stay healthy, things like that. And again, he got injured, so he was out for, you know, a significant portion. But he also wasn't getting much time, even when when he was healthy. And so if he can remain healthy, he's got some fresh legs. But Darrell Williams injuring his toe, and, you know, Edwards-Helaire being out with the shoulder and Darrell Williams with the toe is why I looked at McKinnon and said, you know, if they need somebody to step up, if they've got some injuries, it would be odd if he's the one that saves the day because other guys are injured. Would be an interesting little turn of fortune for him. But the Edwards-Helaire one's interesting because he should be playing this weekend. The way that Andy Reid talked yesterday sounded pretty optimistic that he would expect him to play. Tyreek Hill, he talked about that as well, that he expects him to play. So maybe if there's a full workload for Clyde Edwards-Helaire, and if Darrell Williams, if he's optimistic that he's going to, quote, participate in the game, then maybe McKinnon then slides back to being a guy that is just sitting on the sideline and plays some special teams, and he's out of the running. And it is Clyde Edwards-Helaire getting an opportunity to make some big plays, have a big game or two, and move up in the pantheon of great Chiefs players in, you know, championship runs. Like, Sammy Watkins is viewed differently in this town because of that three-game stretch, because of the 2019 playoffs. If he was just what he typically was in 18, 19, and 20, it would be viewed as, yeah, that's just not a good signing. They wasted money on Sammy Watkins. So I looked at McKinnon, but I think my main one is going the Sammy Watkins route and going Byron Pringle. Because there's going to be so much focus on Travis Kelce and Tyreek Hill, as there always is, I think it's one of the reasons why Sammy had such a good postseason run. In the last three games, Byron Pringle, 14 catches, 166 yards, and two touchdowns. So maybe that, and you know, maybe that is Patrick Mahomes having more trust in Byron Pringle, him making plays for him. I know Mahomes talks about, I just throw to the open guy. I think there's an element of Mahomes throws to certain guys that he trusts as well. There may be a play to where it's like, okay, I trust him, he's not open. Now I need to find the open guy. But I think Byron Pringle's becoming that for Patrick Mahomes, somebody he can trust. And if that's the case, then I think he can fill that role of a Sammy Watkins to step up and be the second target after Tyreek Hill. Maybe it ends up being Mecole Hardman because of what he did when Tyreek was pretty much out of the game against the Broncos, and he has his first 100-yard receiving game. Maybe it is Hardman that steps up. Maybe it's a combination of those guys. But I just look at the Sammy Watkins element in and his impact in 2019, that Pringle just reminds me of that. And maybe that's the familiarity with it.
And I think there's also the opportunity for him to make plays as a kick returner, since Dave Tobe seems hell-bent on bringing it out every time. That gives Pringle, when you talk about the potential to break out, he could return one for a touchdown in a game. And, I mean, you do that kind of stuff in the post. Hell, we still remember Nile Davis returning a kickoff in a playoff game. I mean, it's the kind of thing that you remember, those kind of big plays. So that gives Byron Pringle another opportunity, because clearly Dave Tobe hates touchbacks.
Or Byron Pringle gets even more love because he does not return a kick. And he just always takes a knee or just lets it go over his head.
One that's kind of a little bit different that I've got. This guy's already had his success, and he's already a name. But Melvin Ingram coming in, and this defense was just a dumpster fire upon dumpster fires. We thought it was worse than Bob Sutton's defense. And he comes in, plays well, defense goes the other way. And then, like, if he has a big playoff run, it's not necessarily he, you know, breaks down. And, you know, like I said, he's already done his thing with other teams. But kind of having that impact for the Chiefs and just being like a hero in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, maybe he builds off the huge play against the Broncos.
He may not be here next year, but we'll remember him for his impact that he did this year in helping turn around the defense.
I mean, if that play is made in the playoffs, then that's one that people will remember forever in the playoffs. Now, I think people remember it for a long time because of the impact and what it meant and the anxiety and the nerves and just the dread of how are you really going to lose the game to the freaking Broncos.
And because of Nick Bolton's return.
That's right.
It will always be, you know, Nick Bolton's first touchdown, and it'll be remembered with that. Like, oh, yeah, but Melvin Ingram's the one that came in and put that hit. He was also a guy that was written off at the beginning of the season. He was kind of talked about in free agency and then ends up signing a one-year, $4 million deal with the Steelers. So the market didn't respect him that much. People were kind of writing him off. The Steelers let him go for a sixth-round pick, and he has this chance to go and show, I've still got something, and could kind of put his name out there.
Yeah,
yes, that's awesome.
Right, and now he gets to play the Steelers this weekend. I've got one that I'm not sure people would come up to or land on, you know, if they're coming up with 3, 4, or 5. Charvarius Ward. Mm-hmm. And I bring him up because if we see where quarterbacks are going, they're not throwing to Legarius Sneed even down the line of scrimmage anymore because he's so good. Like, why would you? Why would you throw down the line of scrimmage in a quick wide receiver, you know, screen type when Legarius Sneed is over there? He covers that better than anybody I can remember. So they're not throwing to his side. The safeties aren't really getting picked on either.
Unless it's Dan Sorensen.
So if you're throwing to the outside, it's been when Mike Hughes has been in the game, and he's only in there sporadically. Ward's in there every single play, mm-hmm. and teams have been throwing to Charvarius Ward's side. If he steps up and plays like he has at certain points in his career when he's been a really good cornerback, one, it obviously helps the Chiefs in the secondary if he could do that. Two, he makes himself a lot of money in the offseason if he were to be able to do that. People are going to remember Charvarius Ward and Ja'Marr Chase in the offseason, and it may cost him some money when people go, yeah, but if you're wanting this much money, this is what you did against a really, really good receiver. If we bring you in as a cornerback and pay you that much money, we expect you to play on...
It's like, look, I was there every time.
Right, he just made plays. Yeah, you got to make the play if you want this much money. If he can get to a level of what he was doing before the Chargers and Bengals game, I think that would be incredibly significant for this team. Because then where are the quarterbacks throwing? Who are they picking on if it's not 49? You
know, it's... Let's also not forget the Tommy Townsend Redemption Tour that we are about to see in the postseason. I mean, he's going to put on a spectacle with that cannon he's got for a right leg.
And a right arm.
We're going to forget about his playoff failures of the past.
Never forget about that punt in the Super Bowl.
Yeah, but that punt didn't. He wasn't good, but that punt didn't cost them the Super Bowl. So.
It's the difference in the Super Bowl to me.
Is it?
Yeah, this
Tommy Townsend
thing.
Lost them. How Tommy Townsend lost Patrick mm-hmm. Mahomes a chance at a three-peat, my column.
I think there were ways you could overcome the offensive line and the defensive issues and the penalties, but you can't overcome that punt
True.
At that time.
True.
It was just nothing you could do. All right, we'll take a timeout. We'll come back, wrap up this hour, talk with Todd Lebo in the 1 o'clock hour, Factor Fiction, some other things, as well as we continue on Tuesday here on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
The Zone with Jason Anderson.
And I want you to understand how you can get more meat.
Weekdays from 10 to 2 on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
We're all looking for more meat, right, Beards?
913-912-4810. Tech says, I'll call it now. The Josh Gordon Show in the playoffs. Tech comes in and says...
Don't sign me up for that. I don't think that's happening.
Tech says, any chance Josh Gordon turns into Josh Gordon?
I think he has.
Another text says, it'll be Josh Gordon. He'll all of a sudden stop dropping passes and be the contributor with not. Not going to happen. That was the text that said that. I did not interrupt the text. Then a couple of texts about Corey and his sneaky pick there at the end. Says, I personally hope we don't see Tommy Townsend in the playoffs.
That'd be great.
Also, Jason, why does Corey hate the Chiefs so much? He wants Townsend to punt all the time and not the Chiefs to score touchdowns.
Ah, he'll just drop a couple of nicely placed bombs when needed.
Just from one a game.
Works for me.
Averaging 65 per punt.